Hi and welcome back to the Guru Performance We Do Science podcast, sponsored by Healthspan Elite. For more about Healthspan Elite, I'll bring you that information at the end of the podcast. So, this is take two. welcome back, Professor Andy Lane. How are you doing, Andy?
I'm doing very well, and I will probably be better on this second go than I was on the first go.
Listeners
have been spared.
They have. They don't even know what we're talking about.
No. Well, we had a go at Skype technology. Decided to say no. It tested our resilience.
It did.
Our ability to communicate was hampered by probably a low flying aeroplane going over Walsall.
It was. That was exactly what happened. So, for those that haven't heard you speak before, because of course you've been on this podcast before. Do you want to just quickly remind the listeners or the new listeners as to who you are?
Okay, I am Professor Andy Lane. I'm a professor of sports psychology at the University of Wolverhampton. I am a Health Professionals Council registered, BASIS accredited and chartered, and BPS chartered. That's quite a lot of qualifications, but they're important to get. And we might talk about the training routes of that going on later on in this podcast. My areas of research are emotion, mood, psychological skills, interventions to help people perform better, interventions to help people feel better when they're moving. Quite a lot of work we're doing at the moment is with UK Active to get people active, to increase amounts of movement. Supervised quite a lot of PhD students, and now I have PhD students who I've supervised other students. That makes me a PhD grandfather, which is slightly scary, but we're quite a new subject, and that's quite possible. And the great grandfather thing possibly could be coming in a year or two as well, which will really make me feel ancient academically.
No, brilliant. Yeah, you're sort of the granddaddy of PhD,
but not at all. Not at all. The same. We've got great 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 grandfathers.
Brilliant.
In our area, which is just really good because it just shows that the area is developing.
Absolutely, yeah. So listen, before we were recording, and before take one of this podcast, we were you had noticed, of course, that in the video, because we're recording audio and we're recording video, recording audio, but you and I were looking at each other on video. You had noticed that I had some Matisse pictures up on our lab wall here, because I'm in my lab, and I was explaining that I have realized over time how important it is to not just, you know, deliver what I consider to be, you know, a great service, but it's also the environment in which I provide that service and the various things, the various factors that influence how I improve my client's perception of the quality of service, the way I dress up the information. You know, I don't just scribble down someone's test results or recommendations. I go to great lengths to produce wonderful looking reports, and you know, we make sure that we dress appropriately and look great, and all these things are very important factors which aren't often discussed by sports scientists, or, you know, people allied to sports science, when we talk about the rocket science, the mechanisms. But it's that business of communication, yeah, which is sort of the topic of today's podcast.
We could pitch a lot of that in a theory called self-efficacy theory. The author of which started that, I've got 25,000 citations just to see, just wow, as an incident of just how well recognized that research is. And that would say that the credibility of the persuader has a massive influence on the information that's being given. And the idea that improving confidence makes people feel better about what they're about to do, and if people are more confident, they'll persist at things for longer and select those areas more often. In other words, confidence is quite an important aspect in behaviour change, and quite a lot of what we do as practitioners, whether in all areas, is about getting people to do things different or slightly better.
Yeah.
And part of that would look at the credibility of the persuader. So if we give an example of someone is in the park and they're doing some sit-ups and they're doing a bit of exercise, and Steve Redgrave comes up to them, multi-Olympic medal winning athlete, says, "Oh, well, you're looking pretty fit there. You're going to keep going at that. You'll get yourself in really good shape in the next few months. That's just the sort of thing I used to do. That would have a massive, or should have a massive influence on their confidence to repeat that again. If, for example, they're doing their sit-ups, and it's about some contrast to that, and someone with their dog walks over, scruffily dressed, says, you don't want to do it like that. No, you don't do it like that. Well, it looks all right, but you don't really want to do it like that. And offers then some feedback. They have got no credibility with the person who's looking at them. And it could well be that, it could well be that the same piece of information given by both people is interpreted really, really differently. Yeah. And so even if the person said exactly the same thing as what Steve Redgrave said, it could have the opposite effect of improving confidence but reducing confidence, in that the person doing the exercise could say, well, what do you know about it? What do I know about you that says you know about it? Or what we try to do as practitioners, the qualifications that we've got add a degree of credibility. The environment where we see people makes people feel that we are professional in our approach, that we know what we're doing. We're giving indicators, we're trying to give information to people that says we know what we're talking about.
Absolutely.
People, you know, athletes, whoever comes to see us is potentially placing an enormous amount of trust in the information we're about to give. And we are giving positive reinforcement to say that is worth doing by the way we present ourselves. You know, but there can be many, many, many ways of doing that. It's not simply that a smart shirt and tie will add credibility.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting, some of the research that has looked at relationships between the practitioner and the client would say that, yeah, it's okay to dress in a very professional way, in a very shirt and tie, but actually, sometimes that doesn't actually give you a close relationship with the client.
No.
Sometimes it's actually better to dress so that they feel more relaxed in your presence. If you want them to tell, you know, want them to open up in a certain way, feel comfortable, thinking that you're the doctor about to offer solutions, and you know, take three of these, come back next week, and it's fixed, which isn't actually, I know in psychology, we haven't got anything, we haven't got any evidence where we can say, do it with that level of prescription. So you are looking at your credibility. You're building your relationship, building trust, and it may not necessarily be about dressing in a certain way.
Yeah.
It's about building that relationship, understanding what the person's needs and wants are at the start.
Absolutely, yeah. And I it's fascinating. I can honestly say, and as I was mentioning in take one of this podcast, that something I've been doing is my own professional doctorate that I've been doing is a huge amount of reflective practice I'm delving into my own practice and looking at, well, you know, why have I been so successful in my interventions? Because actually in my review of what I've done, I spent a fair amount of time actually practicing not in what I would now call an evidence-based sort of area. In fact, I would consider what I was doing completely wrong, and yet I still had very successful outcomes, because back then I had already recognized the importance of communication and professionalism and that client practitioner relationship has been something that I've always had a huge amount of respect for, and it is that I think is one of my personal most powerful attributes to my own practice is the way in which I do that. And yet it's something we don't really talk about when we develop practitioners. At least it hasn't been in my experience in the sports nutrition field.
In psychology, it's massive. Yeah. Reflective practice is a fundamental, pervades all aspects of training. Right from the start, the idea to being reflective, thinking through what you did, why you did it, what worked, what would you change, and really trying to unpack that the inner story that goes on when you're doing your work and thinking about doing your work, it's a really important thing. And I mean, I think that psychology, when you looked at roots of training, when I've done it with the British Association of Sport and Exercise Scientists, were always sort of psychology pitched themselves up as we do it better, almost kind of felt that way, which I thought was a bit harsh. It's partly to do with the sort of the subjective nature of what they're looking at. You can't get into someone's head very easily. So you're trying to unpack thoughts and feelings about yourself, and you can work that out. That's got an impact on someone else. That's all part of the territory. It's less so part of the territory potentially for a physiologist, but I don't think it should be. And I think that how you present your information is massively important. What are the goals of the client in terms of an understanding? And from a psychologist, would really try to unpack what the person's like, what their own views are like in terms of how they may affect their client, but particularly what the views of the client are in terms of their goals, what they want from something. Mm. And that is that what they then say and how the individual then picks it up is going to be extremely useful to what they're to whether you're going to be effective or not, which is all psychology. Which is, we talk of goals, we talk of, okay, you're coming in for nutrition advice, you say, well, if you eat this, this, and this, you'll get this, this, and this. Partly true, always partly true. But unless we understand from the sort of goal perspective of how important that is to someone and where those challenges lie, it'll be very difficult. A goal conflict, just as a starting point of some of the areas that we can get into, it's really important in the eating literature, and the idea that people have goals to be thin, but goals to enjoy their food. And they may not be conscious of these goals. They may be running underneath their consciousness. So when they talk about to a nutritionist in that context, what's your goal, and say, I want to lose weight, that is totally true. But later on that day, when they're presented with something, with a cake or something, the other goal is now being primed by a nice cake, suddenly takes over as the goal, and guilt comes in after eating it.
Yeah.
As the enjoyment of eating the food becomes a primary goal in that brief period of time.
Yeah.
Understanding the complexity of the individual about those multiple goals, the psychologist would do their best to try and unpack that goal conflict, which would underline quite a lot of the difficult eating behaviours, which also could explain why on eating diaries we only get half the stories, because of the salient goal at the time of writing it might well be to lose weight, and you're hiding or trying to hide the conflict that comes with that, as of the lapses.
Yes.
Rather than just recognise, I mean, I love the once you realise that you've got these two goals, one to lose weight, the other to enjoy your food, you can periodise when you allow one goal to be dominant, the other goal to lie sleeping, without beating yourself up over it.
Actually, I love the way you use the word periodization. As you may have heard in my other podcast, I'm really getting into periodization. My original background was a strength and conditioning coach, so I'm very familiar with periodization. And you know, as a sports nutritionist, I have come to realize the importance of periodizing nutrition. But of course, this goes for anything. So of course, periodizing your psychology. I mean, everything needs to be periodized. Of course, we can over periodize stuff, and then it just becomes chaos, like you were discussing offline earlier. We have to be careful also about over complicating stuff, don't we?
Absolutely, but I do, you know, it really helps to work with someone to try and unpack what their goals are. Mm. And not the goals. Goals is something that is used dreadfully in many senses, smarter goals and make them specific on something. Goals are other things that are, there are values to what we deem as important. They drive much of our behaviour. When you look at the goal setting theory literature, it says everything is goal directed. At the moment, we could say we are our goal. We could say what? Why are we doing this podcast? We could say it's to promote science to the rest of the world. That might be one goal. That might be the goal we say. But the actual goal, which underlines that, is that it's self-promotion. I'm doing this so that everyone knows who I am, that people think that I'm knowledgeable in this area. But I may be masking that by what I'm going to say. There'll be multiple goals and multiple different levels. We need to unpack people's values, beliefs about what's going on to actually work out and help them work out when there's what are their important goals. And one way of doing that is when you get clashes in behaviour, where you wanted to do something but ended up doing something else, and exploring their thoughts at how that came about is a way of going, I set out by wanting to do this, but then I managed to talk myself out of that. What was the underlying motive that led me to talk myself out of the very act I wanted to do to start with? Because there's a journey that someone goes on in their mind where they might set out to do know, they often with diet they set out to avoid eating cakes, and then they're primed, then the cake comes along and they end up eating cakes, and they rationalize to themselves, I'll just have the one. Well, at that one process, what was going on at the point when you talked yourself out about that? Let's get into that little bit of where you've said, well, actually it's now important for me to eat the cake. What is it about? Was it in a social setting where you wanted to fit in? Was it really that you really needed to eat this cake because it was something totally desirable about the cake? You could get into that and be able to help the person be able to see some of the environmental triggers, yeah, which prompt them to make that goal become important. Which, yeah, then when those triggers come about next time, they then have a way of going, actually, today that goal is going to lie second to my primary goal, and I'll help myself overcome it.
Yeah. Now that process
is raising yeah, self-awareness. But physiologists, nutritionalists are dealing with the subject matter, yes, of which is vital for that.
Yeah.
Because people say to me, "What shall I eat to lose weight?" And I say, "Less." Yeah. Right? And they say, "No. Exactly, what do I need to eat?" And I say, "I'm not a nutritionist. I mean, now I'm struggling." Mm-hmm. And so on, but that, you know, the working together, that interdisciplinary approach is fundamental.
Oh, completely agree. I mean, you know, I think, you know, those of us that look at the literature, we can all agree that the diet that seems to result in the most successful outcome of weight loss is the one that you can consistently do.
Yeah.
And of course, there are factors that influence that. Which brings us back to communication. You know, that person's belief in the nutritional plan that you've designed for them it is going to be influenced by, you know, their belief in you and the belief in the outcomes of your interventions. If you're able to impart upon them that, if you can't, you have to find another strategy, don't you?
I mean, diet and beliefs is massive, and I think I said this on the last podcast. With, you know, when I've worked in boxing, the beliefs regarding what you can and can't do around diet just drive everything you do. Drive everything that they're doing, and boxers will believe that they can regain strength having lost huge amounts of weight, and they can't. And we can demonstrate that they can't, but their belief that they could lose that and then win is supported by evidence when somebody does lose an enormous amount of weight. Two very weak boxers get in together, and one of them ends up winning, and that could well be you. So it's reinforced in the environment to the point that it gets supported. But the idea that you'd say, well, you know, that's probably not going to work if you cut out all your food for 3 days just so that you can make this weight. You will be weaker. Yeah. You won't be able to replace it. That's the evidence. They go, no, the culture says I can. People in the environment have done it before, and therefore you are in a very difficult position before you are then credible to actually make that change. Yeah. That raises another point, I think an interesting point about working with any sport is the credibility of the practitioner within that environment.
Definitely.
And I know many people who become practitioners were athletes themselves, and many of them have played sport to a reasonable level, but not really a very high level. They know about the sport, and I was thinking this soccer I find a very difficult sport to do work in. And when I'm looking at people who have done work in soccer, often those people who are quite good, who assume that they've got knowledge of the sport, find it quite difficult to get accepted. And you wonder why that is the case, but it might well be the case is that they go in there and they tread over barriers that isn't really their area. So they're offering psychological support or offering some kind of support which borders on what the coach would do. The player looks at them and will go, well, how good are you at soccer? How many goals did you score? They haven't got that immediate credibility because they weren't former players.
Mm.
And they find it very difficult. That's why sometimes the sports psychologist who doesn't look like an athlete, has got no real connection to the sport, can be very effective because they know their territory.
Yeah.
And everyone else knows their territory, and they don't go and join in five-a-side games, and they they're not that physical around the group, because that blurs boundaries, and the people then see them for the value of what they're at, what they've got, and they get credibility that way.
Yeah, you mentioned boundaries. I've worked a lot in team sports, mostly professional rugby for quite a few years. I was the team nutritionist, but like most team nutritionists, you're not actually a permanent member of staff. You know, you're contracted to come in, say, in my case, usually it was one day a week. Now, what I found was, you know, I'd get on well with the players, but I wasn't going to get on. I wasn't as familiar with the players as the sports science team, you know, the strength and conditioning coaches, for example. Yeah. So although I'm the expert in sports nutrition, they would still ask the nutrition questions to the S&C staff. And that kind of, you know, led me to come up with the idea of, well, I'm gonna certainly turn up, but I'm also going to try and deliver my interventions through those professionals, so that we're all singing from the same hymn sheet and that sort of thing. And that works so much better than just trying to do it on my own.
I mean, absolutely. I am not super persuasive. I'm not super credible. I'm not, you know, I look at some of my colleagues who are very, very charismatic, and I'm not that charismatic. And I think, well, actually, I know a lot about this stuff. But I'm not going to immediately build brilliant relationships with people, because I know that about myself. I build reasonable relationships, but it's not going to be brilliant. It's not going to be super influential. It's not going to be that charismatic. And some people almost operate in a way that they think they can do that. Once you realise that, well, a quiet word with someone on a one-to-one where that level of extroversion is just not necessary, and then getting the coach who has got that charisma, has got that influence with the players to do that, is far, far more powerful. Mm. Far more powerful. And you don't have to worry then that the players are not going to resent what you're going to say, because if you can persuade the coach then takes it forward. You have these multiple benefits that the coach will be there far more than you are. There is far less availability of misinterpretation, and the coach is then reinforcing the message that you want to do and coming to see you for an update in the knowledge.
Yeah.
And it makes your life far less stressful, far less risky, and you are far more effective. But you're not. But this is one of the things certainly in psychology, when we ask people in their, you know, when they're practicing Viva, is why do you want to be a psychologist? What are you here for? What are your values? Similar to, you know, what I talked about on the podcast. The being effective, but in the background, never being recognised, is something sometimes quite difficult for a psychologist. Sometimes quite difficult for a practitioner to know that they did instigate some change, but actually nobody ever says it's to do with them. But actually, if you're there to actually make a difference, that might be your best way of working. My personal thing is not to put name, is not on any of the stuff I do, is to say any of the athletes I've worked with, so that I'm not trying to make these claims that you know, I am anyway part responsible for any of their successes, because it doesn't. I see the people who do, and I understand why, and it's very good for their marketing. And if I was doing this as a full-time job to try and get money in, then I might think that I have to market myself that way. But I do question whether that's appropriate. That's, an athlete's very good, and you've had some working with them, and therefore you want to be on the marketing brand that helps you get you further work. I'm just not convinced by that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a difficult. So this is sort of a segue into another area of interest, is how we sell ourselves, and that's always a struggle. And I think everyone that's listening to this, and you can take this out of the sports science arena to any arena, is you know, what am I worth? How do I charge for my services? Yeah. You know, that sort of brings back you to that comment you've made. You know, you feel the need to say, well, I've worked in such and such a team, such and such has been my clients, that's how I justify my cost, or, you know, I've spent most of my life in university, therefore I'm going to charge more than blah, 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 blah. And yet you see people who've done none of those things who make an absolute fortune because they found another way of marketing themselves. That's another side to communication, I guess, that warrants some thought here.
You know, you need to put a value to your services. Someone's going to come in and spend some time with you. You know, you're not worth nothing. I know people in their training was asked me the question, well, how much should I charge? How should I do sessions? I said, well, you've got to delimit your time. You know, people are going to be booked in. If they see your time as valuable, they'll turn up. If they don't see it as valuable, they won't. And sometimes that reflection on their part and your explanation to them of what they're going to get from this is worth it. And if they turn up or not, then it is deemed worth it. Don't open it up as an open-ended thing so they can turn up anytime and anywhere. Otherwise, you'll be the person. You will be seen as the person who, you know, who makes the tea and stuff. You know, you'll have no value to them whatsoever.
Yeah.
You know, you don't overcharge people. You don't, and you want to give good value. But that's then saying, if you come to me, we'll talk about these things. I've got expertise in this area, and this is where I see the benefits of it. And you sell the service by what the benefits can be to the person, and hopefully they can see something in that. That they go, well, that will be very helpful to me.
Yeah. Actually, a strategy that I personally have found useful, and I've done it for a while, is I virtually never work with a client on a sort of one-off appointment basis. I expect a commitment from them because I know realistically that in order to get any value out of working with me, you're going to have to commit to a period of time of working with me, you know. Otherwise, I don't feel comfortable selling my services because I know it's not going to work as a one-off, you know. And that has worked very well. And by that, I mean I get them to commit to usually a minimum of a 3-month period with me. I know there's lots of different ways of approaching this, and people will worry about, well, you know, but I'm worried about, you know, people not wanting to afford. Or make that commitment, but then you might be doing yourself a favour by avoiding clients that aren't willing to commit.
Yeah, there are some really unrealistic expectations about what sports science can provide, and when you look at particularly psychology, when I look at what my colleagues in clinical psychology, I talk to them about, you know, would anyone expect you to make much difference in how many sessions would they expect you to make much difference? And they will give long-term answers. In sport, it's almost that you're expected to fix the person up in seconds, right? Sports psychology is coming in, wielded in at the edge of crisis, waves a magic wand, and everyone's better. Is the expectations within some people, and within some sports teams, and getting into that, walking into that, is a recipe for setting yourself up for failure. But on saying that, you can tell people. I'll tell you, I can come and give a talk to your group of people. I can give a talk about sports psychology. I can talk about the overview, the area. You know, it's an educational based talk. You get a one off. Be more than happy to do that for people. But the expectation is that, you know, they're not necessarily going to get what they're looking for from that.
So Andy, you've made me think of something, which is something I sort of started to do after a while when I realized that when a client is considering working with me, I need to be aware of what stage of change they're in. This idea of, and I know there are various models here, you know, you've got your, are they in pre-contemplation or contemplation or determination, action, maintenance or termination? Yeah. There's different ways of explaining this. I mean, how much importance do you think as practitioners, and I'm thinking not psychologists specifically, but any kind of practitioner, to be aware of what stage of change, or, you know, what place is that person in terms of their ability to commit to some sort of intervention?
I mean, that's quite a nice way of looking at it, because it chucks places any intervention within a psychological framework, and then when you think about it in those terms, we'll go, well, hold on, what What training have those disciplines had? What those practitioners in those disciplines had in those frameworks to begin with, which makes think, oh, not a lot, and not really encouraged to do so. And what that does from the practitioner's perspective is a very nice way of looking at why what they're about to do may not be very effective, and why in looking through. When you've got someone trying to work with them, trying to find out what's going on, is why nothing seems to be effective. Yeah. And there's parts where you can be talking to people, and they might have booked an appointment to see you, but really the reason they've booked an appointment is not for their reasons. They feel they ought to do it, but don't really want to do it. And this is almost New Year's Day resolutions, in that people say, I need to lose weight. And they know they ought to lose weight, and they know they ought to exercise more, but they haven't really reflected on what that means in terms of 2 weeks in, when you're a bit tired, and the option to have a quick snack on the way home, the only thing is a chocolate bar, and you were going to go to the gym on the way home, and you then were going to have this nice healthy meal, which on January the 2nd you'd planned perfectly, because that was your goal, the really important goal. Everything else, all the rest of your life was organized into that. Since then, your other goals have taken over. You've got work related goals have come forward. At the point of eating the chocolate bar, the goal was, I'm feeling tired, I'm feeling a bit cheesed off, chocolate bar will cheer me up. And we're unconscious about all of those things. The person, I mean, until the person goes, actually, no, I'm going to. I know I've got these competing goals. I know I'm going to organise my life so that when I have these thoughts around eating the chocolate bar, I'm going to have a barrier. I'm going to have a way of thinking that stops me from doing that or prevents me from doing that. Three times a week, I'll do it once a week. It helps me manage and regulate that within line with the primary goal that you're going to achieve. You won't get the outcomes you want. I mean, I can't remember what version it is, but again, goal conflict theory talks really nicely, and it's not really looked at in sport, but it is in other areas of psychology, of how goals clashed, and when those goals clash to influence what they really prevent us from doing what we think we ought to be doing, because we're unaware of the conflict that's going on, and we haven't got flexible control over our goals. We can't say, actually, we'll take this goal now and this goal later, and I'm not certain about how much I want to commit to that right now. We just say that we want to commit to it, and then we fail and we beat ourselves up for the failure. And if we understand that we've got these competing goals, and we are far less harsh on ourselves, we permit ourselves to have lapses, and we also can encourage ourselves to jump back on the bike and get going again in a way that's really positive. And if we're damning with ourselves and we see failure all the time, it produces these periods where we just give up, because we don't like what emotions come with failure: misery, dejection, unhappiness, feeling really bad about yourself. We don't like experiencing those. We will seek to avoid them in an anticipatory sense. So as soon as we think about the environment where that could occur, it might well trigger thoughts to go and do something else, all mashed up in momentary seconds. Yeah. Where the act of I was planning to go for a run, I was planning to eat this for dinner, is then switched over as the next goal launches itself in top of what you're going to be doing.
Yeah, see, this stuff's fascinating. And actually, I while you were saying that, it also reminded me of something I'd read somewhere or heard somewhere. It was something along the lines of the science of selling. And it's along the lines of, when someone contacts you to inquire about your service or product, they've already made some sort of decision, potentially unconscious decision, to buy it or to make that appointment. What happens next is down to us. And if in the process of us describing our service or sending them information or whatever it is that we do, if they don't come back to you, chances are that it was us that changed their mind. That I find interesting.
Or they had no idea what they were going to get to begin
with. That's true, yeah, but it comes down to communication again, doesn't it?
Yeah. Certainly, I mean, the aspect of that, why communication is fundamental to that, is listening to what they're coming for, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the within communication, we often might be thinking about what we're saying, but the you know, we've got two ears and one mouth for a reason, is what my colleague said when I'm doing this podcast on Friday. He said, well, emphasize that communication's more about listening than it is about talking. It's more about working at what they actually mean rather than what you're telling them as to whether you're going to be effective or not. And that the active listening part of communication is something which, again, in terms of training as practitioners in psychology, will be encouraged and encouraged and encouraged. The reflective process of when people get their feedback from their stage one and stage two, part of their training for BPS, they will be encouraged to be active listening and really working out what your client is, where your client's coming from, what their values and beliefs in that environment and how they're being influenced. Because that is fundamental to what you're going to say, do, and how you're going to work with them.
Yeah, no, that's a brilliant point, Andy. It was something, again, in my own reflective practice process, something that I realised. I got to a point where I was pretty successful, but I also got to a point where I stopped listening to what my clients wanted because I felt, well, I know what they need.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm the expert here. I'm the one that's super brilliant at what I do. So I'm just going to bark at them as to what they should do, and if they didn't achieve their goal, well, it's because they didn't want to or whatever. And no, you need to hear them, but also you need to be realistic about it. You know, I think it's like people going in for a haircut. You know, they go in with an idea in their head, or remember those days where you used to. Maybe they still do this, but you sort of go in and you they have magazines, you pick up them, or they have those pictures on the wall, and you go, right, there's Brad Pitt, I want to look like him. Fact is, there's no way. No way. It doesn't matter how you might be the most amazing hairdresser in the universe. I'm not going to look like Brad Pitt because I look more like Laurel from Laurel and Hardy. You know?
Yeah.
So realism, I mean, we've got to be realistic, haven't we?
I just tell the barber to cut the grey bits off, which my wife has been painting in when I sleep. And I say that to her every time. They do seem to be spending more time cutting them out. That's just right. So she's been aggressively painting them in the evenings. it really is. You know, the one of those the points that is. That doesn't necessarily place everything what the client says as being right. It means you've got to listen to what they're saying, and you know, we often taking a client-centered view. You have to listen to where they're coming from. That doesn't necessarily mean that you have to support it. You just need to know why they're doing it, what the goals are, which underpack something what they're doing.
Yeah.
And you might want to change those, but by listening to what they're saying. You might just realise how enormous that is in terms of the difficulty of trying to make that change. There's lots of sports nutrition and branding and beliefs that come out about the product. People are pretty transient in their beliefs at the moment, or that they are currently a lot of my running friends are all, I think I said this last time as well, they are beetroot juicing to death.
Yeah.
And they've got really powerful beliefs that beetroot juice works. And there's lots of evidence to say that this beetroot juice works. And so the idea that you say, are you sure it works? What evidence have you got it works for you?
Mm.
They go, no, it works. I've read it on this podcast here or looked at it on this bit here.
Yeah.
Just if you suggested them, I'm not certain about that. I'm not certain that works for you. Not that I'm going to say that, but I do think that people shouldn't be blindly swept away by the packaging on the side because they are at risk of being anything. Is that for most athletes, you need to think, well, you know, does that work for you? You can always test these things out on your own. In your own way, and you can do that by doing them in relatively controlled conditions. So if you're using beetroot juice and you do a 5x800 meter session, or you do a 5x1k session, or you do one session, you repeat and you repeat and you repeat, why don't you test it out before that session, which is relatively standard in your program? Because You know, why not you get get some of your own data regarding whether that works or whether that doesn't work, and how much variation you've got? Because if on one day you perform brilliantly and another day you perform differently, and you've largely done the same thing, or you think you've done the same thing, then it's unlikely to be the beetroot juice that's caused you to improve better on the day that you can't claim beetroot juice performed really well on the day you had beetroot juice, because you also had beetroot juice on the other day and didn't go so well. There's other factors that are going on to that, maybe residual fatigue. But the beliefs will go is that they took beetroot juice in a race, performed really well. Could be for lots of reasons. Beetroot juice is the cause.
Yeah,
beetroot juice is then the belief. And that's not just beetroot juice. That is, beetroot juice is just the latest, which runners will do. Yeah. And you go around the Tesco's and Morrison's and all the supermarkets have rows and rows and rows of the stuff.
Yeah.
And I know the younger people in the gyms spend all their time shaking, putting stuff into bottles to shake up,
yeah.
and then to go and do some amount of training. You think, my God, the price these people are paying to try and get what their goals are, or which might well be, you know, improve their physical appearance, is huge. And they're reading this stuff on the side, and I am not convinced at all that they're going to make much difference. And they're not going to make, and particularly young people who are about 17 or something, they have a much easier mechanism for getting bigger because they could just train more.
Yeah. Well, for point of reference, we've actually done a podcast all about beetroot with Andy Jones, Professor Andy Jones, and that stuff's fascinating. But this is why I use the word context all the time, because it does depend. You know, if you put it into the bigger picture, some of this stuff just isn't relevant. And I guess this is, I mean, this segues into the next point I wanted to get into, which is this business of how sexy something is, not how sexy someone is, Andy. How sexy something is, and. You know, I'm always trying to enforce the importance of basics, mastering the basics, because that really is, you know, basic, like regular activity, being consistent with that, a solid diet, robust, you know, a quality diet, whatever that is. But the fact that you have to do that consistently, the thing is, that's not very sexy. However, if I say, right, a couple of sprints followed by this pill, and you're going to look like David Hasselhoff, you know, that's sexy. In fact, listeners, I'm not saying that the Hoff is sexy.
I think you should. He brought the Berlin Wall down.
Damn it! Yeah, my thoughts have been released. There you go.
The man who released Eastern Europe, David Hasselhoff. Remember watching it?
Oh my God!
Hoff on the wall.
That's right.
I mean, that is, you know, the media are very, you know. Branding to make the message look attractive is massively persuasive, and practitioners go nowhere near that type of approach to try and sell themselves.
Yeah.
And many of them would be against that type of approach, and I understand why, because it looks a bit cheesy. But the reason these products are so effective, or one reason they're so effective, is that they are credible. They create a sense of credibility. And that credibility, the beliefs that this will work, is absolutely huge. On an aside to this, and controversially, the recent program where the journalist took EPO.
Yeah, I watched that. Yeah, it's very interesting.
Very interesting. And the what would have been interesting would be to have a different journalist or the same journalist take something which he thought was EPO. Wasn't EPO, and where the person had really powerful beliefs that this is something positive is about to happen. Because when you read the autobiographies of those usually riders who have taken the drugs, we'll talk about the expectation that exercise felt quite hard, and they thought when they got to this what was normally their max, they thought, God dear, I didn't expect this to feel this hard at this point. And then they said, I seem to be able to go on for much longer. In other words, they could sustain that endurance for much longer. Well, Chris Speedy, in some of the research he's done on where people have placeboed themselves, thought they're taking drugs and they weren't, gets very, very similar stories. I mean, there's no biological agent going on whatsoever, but there's a massive belief effect running in the background. So you've taken something and it has a huge positive effect, and you persist because you believe you've got something extra in the toolkit, in the bag, in your system that will help you perform better. And that is absolutely massive. And if the marketing of any product is bringing that into your system, you've got dual processes that are going on all the time. That is not to say there's not a biological effect, because there will be a big biological effect, but the belief effect that comes on top of that, the icing on the cake, the extra 1% or some percent, is huge. And you can get that for free. You can get that without being an illegal athlete. Mm. And I think that's absolutely fundamental. If people can get that into their training program. So how can I get a training program that I fundamentally believe in? How can I get products that I'm going to take before competition that I know are absolutely perfect for me? The route to doing that is via consistently doing it and knowing that it works. It's the mini experiments I encourage people to do with themselves. They go, okay, if you're going to use beetroot, get some evidence on your own training, your own performance, which shows this improved me by this percent. Mm. And be confident that when you take the beetroot 2 hours before, there's the physical evidence that says it works, which you've got from your training diary and your evaluation, your own reflection on performance, what's going on. And that's really good. But what they're also doing in when they're taking the beetroot juice at that point is they're injecting a massive dose of belief, because it comes with that is the belief effect that comes on top of it, and without the belief effect it's quite difficult. And I think that self-generated or data-generated belief is much more powerful, potentially much more powerful, certainly much better than the marketing on the side, which is persuasive, which might get you to think, get you to it, to take it to begin with.
That's a very important point, and I know as a performance nutritionist working with team sport athletes, one issue I do often come across is I'll be talking to an athlete about, you know, their nutrition, and they will tell me about a supplement that they're taking, and inevitably I in my head I'm like, okay, I've got a couple of decisions to make here. I know in my head that supplement is a waste of time.
Yeah.
However, the reason why he's taking the supplement isn't because I advised it, obviously. Yeah. It isn't necessarily because he just read about it. It's because another member of the team is taking it, and that person is a superior or more impressive, more senior member of the team. Like, so for example, this guy is an academy player. The guy that plays for England is taking this supplement. Now, he might also be endorsing it as part of his own, you know, sponsorship deal or what, you know, these things go on. Now, I have to make that decision of, well, if I take that supplement away from him, what's the risk that, yeah, it might not be doing anything, but then that's an important factor. If it's not doing anything, the fact that I take it away may affect his belief system. And that is important, isn't it?
Oh, well, the best thing, I would do nothing in terms of taking, I wouldn't take that away. I think that would do several things if you took it away. One, it would put you in conflict with the credible person who convinced him to begin with.
Yeah.
And they are probably there more often. They've got the evidence that they've been effective is demonstrated in their performance, which may not be anything to do with that, but that isn't what the psychology is saying. And you're saying it doesn't work, and you haven't actually got any evidence on their terms as to why it doesn't work. Yeah. They haven't got any evidence that it does work, other than the fact that he took it and he's a very good player, their colleague, and I'm taking it and I'm doing okay, and I don't know the extent to which that is attributed to the whatever it's been taken. It's expensive. It's almost a long term view of that, to get, ask people to challenge that, to ask people to then get the data around that. It's almost back to the start or should we get some data on just how much percentage that's working, so people can start questioning it? And the player who encouraged it to begin with is an agent of your change, aren't they? Yes. And that they can stop using it and collectively stop using it. If it's not making much difference, then you might, you know, your energies and it's, you know, if you work out, well, maybe I shouldn't place my energies in that product. But the point, I think one of the points being is that where people are chasing products is an issue. And what you really want is a systematic process where we are confident in something that if it has a small biological effect, that's better. If it has the belief effect, that's even better. You've got the belief effect now in that they're taking it. But it's fragile, isn't it? Because you know, if you, the belief effect's okay, when there's no biological effect going on underneath of it, the foundation of that is slightly questionable, and ethically, I sit uncomfortably by endorsing it. So mine would be not to say anything about it, but also not to think through ways in which I can go actually think.
Yeah.
You know, this is like noise in the background that is not necessarily helping performance. It just reminded me of a PhD student who was doing work with emotion regulation in ice hockey players, and we were talking about the intervention. And it popped up just because they have a lot of caffeine drinks. I go, what do you mean they have a lot of caffeine drinks? He said, well, they're sponsored by, I can't remember, one of those caffeine drinks, any high energy caffeine drinks, and they were knocking barrel loads of this stuff into them. I said, have you not worked out what's going on here? I said, your intervention to change various different bits of arousal control is simply to knock out 50 and drink four of those drinks in an hour, which is what they're doing. You tell me they're doing, they're all sky high, they're caffeine way too high. Just do it yourself and see how you feel. And you know the players had such convincing beliefs that they had to keep their energy up when really they're sitting down a lot, going on bursts of energy back down, sitting down. They're not losing that much water. They're not losing that much energy, and they definitely don't need that much caffeine. There are some benefits in caffeine sometimes, but that dosage of it when you're not used to it just means you can't concentrate. And you know, try and get that challenge into the environment was really difficult. If it's not work, if it's potentially damaging, you might need to really challenge it in a way that stops it going on.
The reason why I was thinking about that is, you know, there's a quite strong movement in the sort of sports scientist, sports science practitioner domain to be evidence-based. And I did a podcast all about that. But I don't like the word evidence-based. I much prefer evidence-informed practice, because of the things that we're discussing now is that if you're only evidence-based, you forget the human beings that you work with who are influenced by more than just evidence, you know. That is an important point that we need to remember when we communicate with our clients, like you say, is that whole, you know, the placebo effect, the belief effect. Fascinating.
But we can get evidence of the belief effect. We can get evidence of that. I mean, but the philosophical position from which you start, which is what psychologists will be asked to explain where they're coming from. You might say, I'm a behaviorist and I look at people's thing and that's how I judge what they're doing. That might be one philosophical approach. I would argue that that beliefs are just as much evidence as anything else. They may well be operating non-consciously, and we may need to get into that non-conscious to be able to tap into just how strong they're working. And it may well be that we need to set something up to show someone that they've got these non-conscious beliefs that are driving a lot of what they're doing. But we can do all that. And we can get evidence to say, you know, difference in behaviour or difference in performance between these two trials is that we manipulated this, and that's all we did. It's exactly the same thing. We just manipulated this, and you reported two completely different experiences, because you hold on to the one set of beliefs, right, that this is happening, and for these reasons why. And can do that. When we do deceptive research, that works really well, in that you can play around with some of those beliefs, and justifiably, because you end up being able to educate the participant in a way how they can self-wreck their performance by holding onto certain sets of beliefs which do so, which become enlightening. But then you get evidence about that. I mean, the study we did with that was manipulating feedback on a 10-mile time trial is one of the examples of that. And all we did was tell people that they're going slower or faster than what they were actually going very early on, with the idea of just improving or making them feel happier or less happy, you know, as a sort of a wrecking ball for their own performance.
Yeah.
when they then with the dialogue that comes out and when they were riding and then when they were describing their performance afterwards, is when they're behind, it was really about this is rubbish, got to perform much harder. And we've got massive physical changes, emotional and physical changes, the difference between the two. Exactly the same thing, ride a stationary bike. But when you think you're behind in performance, you chastise yourself, you try, you have these bursts of power, these peaks of effort, but which can't be sustained, so they're followed by dips of slower performance, which produces exactly the same performance overall. But the quality of the experience was massively different, and the headroom for performance in the pleasant environment was huge. And the idea, if you believe in what you're doing, you have a much greater chance of getting there to begin with. And what that was saying to them is that this, the how they judged their progress very, very early on informed how they then performed thereafter. If they had a different mechanism for judging how well they're doing, they'd perform very differently. If they had a way of calculating effort based on being relaxed on the pedals, which was independent of the equipment they were hooked all over, then they would have been able to maintain the same performance in both conditions, because the feedback would have had no relevance to them if their judges' judgment and their beliefs about how well they're performing were something independent of what we were trying to manipulate.
Yeah.
And you tell that to people and say, okay, you're gonna have multiple different ways of looking at this so that you're not hooked. You get in running races, you can get a bad bit of information which says you've done 8 miles and the 8 mile sign is in the wrong place. Or in a marathon where you're meant to be a pacer, and the pacer goes off mile too quickly, you find yourself in third, fourth, whatever position you're in, and you start getting very negative about your performance. Those negative thoughts can have huge, huge effects. They are beliefs. They don't necessarily have, you can challenge them. You can be thinking, actually, I'm performing as best I can. And these are the internal markers I've taught myself to be able to monitor that allows me to judge that this is as pretty close to as good as it's going to get today. Puts you in a very, very strong, powerful position because you're not so easily persuaded by shifts in the environment in sport where, that turn up for any competition, home and away, in many team sports, there's so much environmental shifts going to affect the day that
absolutely
you're in the unknown. You need to be in the known as much as possible.
Yeah. Well, look, listen, Andy, we're out of time here. Actually, it's been fascinating to get into this, of course. And it's always these sorts of conversations, particularly with you, always highlights to me why it's so important to consider as professionals who we integrate with and when it's a good time to refer. I mean, I'm very fortunate in many of the settings I'm at, like with Great Britain Fencing Team, for example. I have several fantastic sports psychologists who I work with, and I absolutely will admit that in many of my interventions, I would consider their work perhaps more important, if you can even say that. My interventions are incredibly important, but they are so dependent on the beliefs and the psychological state, etc., of my clients that I would consider that integration essential. So
yeah. I say the opposite. And that I work with the physiologists, I think they've sometimes the athletes absolutely home in on those numbers.
Yeah.
If I can, and when I know what they're honing in on, and I know that they are the sort of things that the athlete values, it makes your job really easy just to tune in.
Yeah.
To try and get them to those numbers.
Well, we're all important, Andy. I think that's what we need to recognise. There's the team who have their teammates, but the forgotten teammates are the support staff sometimes. And for every great athlete, there's a whole host of people behind them that have helped them get there. And I'm pleased that we can acknowledge that, particularly with the stuff that we've discussed, how important communication and belief, etc., is. So just very quickly then, for folks that want to learn more about your training programs, etc., that you provide for sports psychology, how do they learn about that?
My website is winninglane.com. It's convenient having a name like Lane, isn't it? Just lends itself that's nothing to do with marketing, that just happens to be that way after a lot of discussion. And my Twitter is AndyLane27. Mongo okay. for those.
Yeah, brilliant.
And there's the university website as well, which is just putting University of Wolves, put my name in, and up I come.
Brilliant, brilliant. Well, listen, thank you very, very much for your time. That brings us to the end of episode 56 on the We Do Science podcast, sponsored by the folks at Healthspan Elite, which are the nutritional supplements we tend to use at Guru Performance, all tested for banned substances by Informed Sport and so on, evidence-based formulas. But anyway, you can learn more about them at healthspan.co.uk/elite. If you want to learn more about the Guru Performance podcast, just check us out at guruperformance.com. And of course, I also lead the International ISSN Diploma Program in Sports and Exercise Nutrition, which you can learn about at ISSNdiploma.com. And of course, I also lead the MSc program in Sports Nutrition at Middlesex University, which you can Google. I, of course, am Laurel Bannock, and I look forward to bringing another podcast back to you all very soon.